Okay, good afternoon. I'm going to call the tax committee to order, and we do have a quorum. I don't know if Representative Liebling has been over there reading March 9th and 10th and 11th or not, and if she's able to move those minutes.
Of course, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling moved the minutes of March 9th, 10th, and 11th of 2009. Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion carries. What we're going to do today, members, is we are going to do the tax committee's version of zero-based budgeting or strategic budgeting or priority budgeting or whatever people are calling it this year. So that's what we're going to try to do here today. And what we want to do is walk people through the actual tax expenditures that are going on in the Minnesota tax system. And I have a note here from Ms. Bergman that the actual tax expenditure budget is not included in committee packets because it's very long, but we can get that for folks who want it. So we're going to work off this today. This is the not long version, okay? So for members of the committee that aren't in a while, you know there's this tax expenditure book that's pretty thick. We're going to look at just portions of the tax expenditure budget today. So if members are ready, we're actually going to have Representative Williams chair of the committee today, but we're going to start with House Research is going to walk us through their presentation and help us think through what we should be doing with tax expenditures this year. So, Mr. Michael, did you want to start? Thank you. And Representative Williams?
I have my eye on him, not to worry.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to start out and do a little bit of a overview to describe what we're doing, and as the chair indicated, we're not going through the entire tax expenditure budget. If we were to do that, I brought my copy of the document along, which is about 200 pages long and smaller type and with a little white space as compared to the 80-page document that you have here. If we were to do that, this would probably be a multi-week effort. So, at the request of the chair, we went through a process to sort of winnow down the tax expenditures that we were going to talk about and present to you. And before we actually get into the discussion of individual tax expenditures, I want to describe two things. One was, what was the process that we used to winnow down this longer list to a shorter list that we thought would be more relevant to the enterprise here at hand? And then secondly, what's the kind of information that we're going to talk about or provide to you or that's in this document? So first, on the question about how did we winnow down or limit the number of tax expenditures that we dealt with, the main criterion was just practicality. There are a whole lot of these tax expenditures, particularly in the individual income tax area, that carry over from federal law and would really not be practical for Minnesota to not continue to follow along. A lot of these involve issues about timing and valuation and similar. So, for example, we don't cover anything that relates to, like, the federal depreciation and cost recovery allowance, those business expense types of deductions, which are, of course, timing issues, pensions, fringe benefits, which involve all sorts of valuation issues, and those kinds of things. So we tried to focus on things that we thought it was sort of realistically, from a tax administration and compliance perspective, that you could talk about either repealing or narrowing down. Secondly, we limited what we were going to talk about to the two major taxes, the individual income tax and the sales tax. So we're not getting into the minor taxes or the business taxes like the corporate tax and so forth. On the sales tax side of things, we focused on consumer, exemptions or tax expenditures that deal mainly with consumer purchases. And the reason for doing that, and there's a little bit of a blurb in the presentation on page 2, is that general tax policy principles suggest that you not tax business inputs. And the reason why you don't want to tax business inputs, if you can help, if you can avoid it, is this problem called pyramiding. And that's a principle or an ideal consumption tax would apply only to consumption, final consumption once, so that you don't have divergent tax rates. So you can imagine a business, for example, that's vertically integrated and large, that can do much of the process of producing, distributing, and selling the product or the service in one entity, is not subject to this pyramiding problem. But if you have a smaller business that actually buys a lot of services and goods from other businesses, and each time it buys, it has to pay the sales tax, what happens is you'll get a sales tax rate that varies by the type of business that you're purchasing the goods and services from. So, in general, we try to exclude the tax expenditures that largely involve these business inputs. So, for each one in the document, and we'll try to run through this fairly quickly so we're not here for, you know, multiple days, which I don't think the committee has time for. But for each tax expenditure that made this list, we have, first of all, a very brief description of that tax expenditure, which this is largely culled from the department's book or from other publications that we've done in House Research and the Fiscal Analysis Department. Then the dollar amount from the tax expenditure budget. Now, there's an important couple things to note about these dollar amounts. First of all, these were prepared back in 2008, used the November forecast from 2007 baseline, so they don't reflect the recession. So if you actually were going to try to limit or repeal one of these tax expenditures, chances are it actually would raise less money than that. Secondly, there's a different methodology that the Department of Revenue uses in producing those tax expenditure budget estimates as compared with revenue estimates. These do not take into account behavioral changes, which revenue estimates typically do. And so that usually will result in you know, differences. A third thing to keep in mind is that you can't just add up all of these tax expenditures and get a total, because there are interaction effects between them. In some cases, if you add them up, you'll get a bigger total, so 2 plus 2 may equal 5. In other cases, you will get a smaller amount because people actually, if you take two itemized deductions away from a taxpayer, chances are at some point they'll go back and be on the standard deduction, and so taking away the second one may not render, you may not realize as much as you did in the first case. So 2 plus 2 may equal 3 in that case. So that's just something to be aware of. The final point to note about the numbers is that these numbers include business purchases. But many of these exemptions, for example, include components of business purchases and consumer purchases. All of the incidence information in the discussion that we're talking about relates only to the consumer purchases. So a bunch of caveats there. The next thing that we tried to do for each of these was to describe what we thought the objective or rationale was for the provision. Sometimes that was clear to us because the members who sponsored them were explicit about it. Sometimes it's written in the law. Most times it's not. And in that case, we either relied on what the literature said, what, you know, published articles said, or we guessed, or in some cases we just said we don't know. The next thing that we tried to do was to identify related direct spending programs. Many of these tax expenditures have, there's also often the spending world, a similar kind of program, and we think legislators probably would want to view them in concert, because you would try to decide, gee, is the tax expenditure approach the best, a better approach, or is the direct spending approach a better approach? And if we have to cut back total effort on this, what's the best way to do it? Now, that being said, all of us are tax people, and we don't know anything much about the direct spending stuff, so we probably missed them, and we didn't try to describe them. So The last thing is, I think this, no, the second, the last thing is, we also provided incidence information. This was all generated by the Department of Revenue from the incidence study. One of the reasons why we, you know, were sort of scrambling to put this together is they had to wait until they finished the incidence study to provide this for us. And so for each of these, for the larger of the tax expenditures where they were able to have data, there are graphs and some and suits indexes that indicate whether or not these expenditures are progressive or regressive and what the effect of repealing them would have on the tax system or on the individual tax. And so you can see that, and we'll talk about that. The final thing that we tried to do in this, we did for the fewest number of these, is to discuss briefly whether or not these expenditures are cost effective in achieving the purposes for which they were laid out. In some instances, there are academic studies of these that provide some pretty good evidence. Most of them, there aren't, and so there's nothing, not a lot that we can say about it other than to sort of suggest some common sense sorts of things. So those are all of the sort of the ground rules, caveats, limits, etc. that go with this discussion. And with that, we're going to start and do the individual income tax stuff first, and then we'll switch to the sales tax. And we're going to tag team back and forth on doing this stuff too. So.
Okay, turning to page 5 of your handout, under Social Security benefits, I will just briefly describe this provision and the revenue loss. I'm not going to go through a lot of detail in the interest of time. To start, again, Social Security benefits, this is an exemption of Social Security benefits subject to federal and state income tax. Depending on the taxpayer's income. The revenue loss, and I'll just mention the fiscal 08 amount, is $159.2 million, and there were 786 Minnesota residents that received Social Security benefits and excluded part or all of these benefits from taxable income. And my colleague, Ms. Manzi, will describe the other provisions or the other of this description.
The rationale for the exemption isn't totally clear. Initially, Social Security benefits were fully exempt from both federal and state law. The federal law was changed first in 1983 and then in 1993 to include a portion of Social Security benefits in taxable income. The federal revenue from taxation of those benefits goes to the Social Security Fund. Minnesota has conformed to the federal changes in which we include up to 85% of Social Security benefits in taxable income. It's thought that the 15% that are excluded represent recovery of the amount that the individual included, while the 85% is direct transfers in the employer contribution portion. The graph is on the screen. Great. The graph shows the distribution by population decile of the tax expenditure for Social Security benefits. So this is showing that 21% of the tax expenditure for Social Security benefits goes to people in the top decile. Those filers are largely going to be subject to either 50% or 85% of their Social Security benefits being included in taxable income. I talked to Dr. Wilson a little bit about why this graph looks like it does, and his instinct was that there are a lot of Social Security recipients who are married couples and who have income from other sources, putting them in the upper deciles. He also pointed out that this graph excludes the tax expenditure for people who are not in the individual income tax system. So there may be a single Social Security recipient who gets a small amount of Social Security and doesn't meet the filing threshold and doesn't file a return. They're not included in this graph. So if those people were added back in, you would see more, a little bit more of the benefit going to the lower deciles. Since it's not, another thing I want to talk about on the graph is what that suits index is. This is actually the suits index for the distribution of this tax expenditure. This is not the effect that you would have on the suits index for the individual income tax if you repealed the Social Security exemption. This is just showing you the distribution of those benefits across the deciles. It's a negative number because if you were to repeal the Suits Index, then the tax would become less progressive. So as we look at these graphs throughout the income tax section and the sales tax section, the ones that show a negative number for the Suits Index, it means that the tax expenditure is distributed in a progressive manner. And the ones that show a positive number for the Suits Index, if repealed, it means that the tax expenditure item is distributed across the population deciles in a regressive manner. And moving on to the effectiveness in meeting the objective, since we're not really clear from congressional intent or anything why it's exempted, we can't say whether it meets its objective.
Okay. On page 6 of your handout, the mortgage interest deduction. Minnesota follows federal law in allowing an itemized deduction for home mortgage interest. The revenue loss in fiscal 08 based on the tax expenditure report is $400.9 million in fiscal 08, and this deduction reduced taxes on 766,000 Minnesota returns in tax year 2007.
This again is another one where we're not at all clear what the original rationale was for it. It's been a feature of the tax ever since it was enacted back in 1933, and the federal tax since it was enacted in 1916. Academic economists sort of speculate or assume that the purpose of the provision is really to either increase the rate of home ownership or to encourage people to improve or better maintain their homes. In terms of related direct spending programs, Minnesota does have a number of programs through the MFHA and then through local and MFHA bonding that attempts to encourage home ownership through providing low interest loans or, you know, various other forms of assistance to homeowners. If you turn to page 8 on the graph, you can see that again, this, as Ms. Manzi indicated, this is one of those instances where the benefits of the home mortgage interest are sort of regressive in the sense that they disproportionately go to the top income levels. It's not quite as progressively distributed as the actual tax burden. So if you looked at the Suits Index, for example, for the income tax liability, it would be slightly higher than that 0.053. But repealing the mortgage interest deduction would make the overall tax system more progressive because it would, you know, be more heavily reliant on the income tax.
Mr. Michael, we do have a question, and members, if you have questions, feel free to let me know, and we'll stop the researchers at any point. Representative Lane?
Thank you, Madam Chair. with regard to the mortgage interest deduction number, I assume that this includes both first and second residence as well as home equity. And if that is in fact the case, is there any way of breaking down how much goes into each one of those categories?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, yes, that is correct. The home mortgage interest deduction is basically you're allowed on one or up to two homes up to $1 million of principal amount and an additional $100,000 of home mortgage, home equity indebtedness. And these numbers are the sum of all three of those. I don't know if revenue has in their incidence database the capability of separating out those components. We would have to check.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I just want to add that sometime in the 1990s, the legislature commissioned a report from the Department of Revenue on that topic, and I have that in my file so I can get the information to you from the time that study was done as to what portion of the tax expenditure was for. I think they did break it out by first home, second homes, and home equity loan. That's not an item that gets reported on the income tax form. There's just one line on Schedule A for the deductible mortgage interest, and it includes all three components. So they had to do additional research over the course of an interim, and they wrote a report to the legislature at that time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would expect that the home equity piece would be the most difficult to pin down, but But I would think that there should be the ability of determining how much is primary residence and how much is secondary residence from what revenue would have. But I'd be interested in what data you have, Ms. Mancy. Thank you.
Representative Garofalo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and just so I understand this information correctly, historically when the federal government has expanded the standard deduction beyond the rate of inflation, one of the side effects of that policy would be to have this graph look like this. In other words, that had the standard deduction stayed where it was at when it was not expanded above inflation, that's why we're seeing these bottom deciles, that cost of the program being gobbled up because it's being rolled into a more generous standard deduction. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, that does explain part of it in the sense that people who essentially have the sum of their itemized deductions is less than the standard deduction obviously do not show up on as benefiting from the home mortgage interest deduction. So that's definitely one piece of the puzzle, that as the standard deduction goes higher in dollar amounts, then that tends to focus the benefit of this deduction on higher income taxpayers. The other component of it, which is probably a more powerful component, is the fact that renters, unlike homeowners, are not allowed to deduct their sort of implicit financing costs of the structures that they live in. And of course, housing tenure is such that higher income people, your income is strongly correlated with home ownership. So in other words, most renters tend to be in the lower income part of the income distribution, whereas homeowners are tend to be in the higher income distribution. So it's those two factors that largely determine the shape of the graph.
Representative Garofalo.
And Madam Chair, if maybe staff can maybe, for those members who want to choose to read the full study, could we maybe get an email copy of it so we don't kill a bunch of trees? But that'd be great if staff could do that for the members of the committee.
So ordered.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure which the full study you're talking about is. That is also available on the department's website, but it would probably be useful because it's not always the easiest thing in the world to navigate their website for us to email that out to people.
Thank you.
So just to talk lastly about the effectiveness of the home mortgage interest, this is something that has been a favorite of public finance economists to study with various empirical studies, and I think there's pretty much an overwhelming consensus that the home mortgage interest is not very effective in actually increasing the level of home ownership. But what it does do is that it encourages people to buy more expensive houses and to borrow more money for that. So I think that's a fair statement of the consensus of the literature.
On page 10 of your handout, the itemized deduction for real estate and other taxes.
Ms. Templer, we do have another question. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While we're still on this topic, does the mortgage interest deduction, do you think, have an impact on interest rates? I mean, wondering, you know, does the existence of this allow, make it easier for a taxpayer to accept the higher interest rates? That kind of go along with what you were saying before about more spending on home ownership?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, it certainly reduces the implicit cost of financing a home purchase as opposed to saving to finance a home purchase. And so in that sense, I suppose that it, could have that effect. I've never seen a study of that kind of thing. The other point that I should make, thinking about this in response to Representative Garofalo's question, the other thing on all of these graphs relative to deductions and subtractions, because Minnesota does not have a flat rate schedule but has a progressive rate schedule, any deduction or subtraction is going to be more valuable in terms of tax save to people in higher tax brackets. And so that's the third factor that will show that these deductions, unless they're capped, tend to have this effect of, you know, the bars going to the right on the incidence.
Any other questions on this area? All right, now, Ms. Templin, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, on page 7 of your, page 10 of your handout, moving right along, the itemized deductions for real estate and other taxes, Minnesota allows individuals to itemize their deductions under federal income tax to deduct real estate taxes as well as the ad valorem portion of the tax on personal property, such as motor vehicle registration. The revenue impact of the deduction for real estate taxes in fiscal 08 was $156 million, and that deduction for real estate taxes benefited an estimated 796,000 returns. And the deduction for other taxes, the revenue loss was $12.2 million in fiscal 08, and an estimated 637,000 returns benefited from that tax provision.
The deduction for property taxes and for other taxes has been part of Minnesota's income tax since it was enacted. Minnesota has followed the federal rules for deduction of real estate and other taxes since 1987. Economists generally view these deductions as a way to provide some implicit aid to state and local governments. And the idea is that the state and local government is taxing, well, the state or local government is imposing property taxes on its residents to provide benefits, some of which have a spillover to people who don't live inside that jurisdiction. So that's the idea behind that part, and it could also be viewed as providing a mechanism for property tax relief. As related direct spending programs, there are extensive intergovernmental aid programs to cities, counties, and school districts, and also direct relief to homeowners through the property tax refund and the homestead market value credit. Here again, we see the same sort of shape of the incidence of the real estate tax deduction, where it's much higher in the higher deciles than in the lower deciles. And turning over to page 12, a similar shape for the itemized deductions for other taxes. This deduction is a little limited in providing state aid to local governments because it tends to target jurisdictions in a way that you might not choose to do it if you were explicitly providing aid. It benefits communities that have more homeowners than renters, since renters aren't able to deduct property taxes. It also benefits communities that pay for things through the property tax, in contrast to those that pay for things through other taxes or fees. So as we get to have more and more local sales taxes to pay for things locally rather than the property tax, this comes into play there. The other issue going on is that some of it is offset. No, I'm not going to say that. Okay. and if the, we'll go on to the other rationale. If the rationale is to just provide property tax relief, it's going to be relatively small because the most you would get, even if you were in the top bracket, is 7.85% of the property taxes that you deducted.
On page 14 of your handout, the charitable contribution deduction. Minnesota follows federal law in allowing contributions to organizations that are religious, educational, scientific, or literary in purpose to be claimed as an itemized deduction. In fiscal 2008, the revenue loss to the state is $208.5 million, and this deduction reduced taxes on about 760,000 Minnesota returns in tax year 2007.
This is another deduction that has been part of Minnesota's income tax since it was enacted. Generally accepted that the intent of this deduction is to encourage people to make contributions to qualifying organizations. The assumption is that when you provide a tax deduction, you reduce the price to the taxpayer of making the contribution.
The graph for the incidence of this shows that most of the benefit goes to the top decile. In this case, the overwhelming driver of that is that people in the top decile make most of the contributions, so that's where most of the benefit goes. Studies of the effect of the federal deduction have shown that it does provide an incentive by reducing the cost of giving for people to engage in charitable giving, and it seems reasonable to conclude that the same thing holds true with the state deduction.
On page 16 of your handout, the subtraction for charitable contribution by non-itemizers, taxpayers who do not itemize deductions are allowed to subtract 50% of their charitable contributions over $500. The revenue loss in fiscal 2008 is estimated to be $7.1 million, and an estimated 168,000 returns benefited from this provision in tax year 2007.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who, just slightly off, but I just wondered, is there something like this analyzing the effect of charitable deductions on the estate tax and the whole issue of stepped-up basis and all those types of things? Or nothing on this order?
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, there have been, in addition, as the document indicates, there have been a bunch of econometric studies of the effect of the income tax deduction. There are also a number of studies of the estate tax deduction for charitable contributions. And in fact, I think it's been a while since I've read them, but my recollection is that those tend to show that the estate tax deduction is a more powerful incentive than the income tax deduction. And so, for example, reducing the estate tax rate or repealing the estate tax would actually have a bigger effect on charitable giving than reducing the income tax deduction would. But I'd have to go back and look at that, but that's sort of what my recollection is.
Representative Dabney?
And of course, I guess, one other thing. You're looking at sort of different populations there, too. With the estate tax, you really focus on the top 2-4% of the population distribution, which you see from the graph. Those are the biggest charitable contributors anyway. And so that effect may be the fact that that incentive is focused precisely on the big charitable givers as it is.
Representative Dabney?
Thanks, Madam Chair. My question is, do we have a chart that shows us the distribution of itemizers versus non-itemizers? It just struck me with this that I wonder what the comparison of this would be to simply the distribution of non-itemizers across the income deciles.
In these materials, we do not have that. We do not have a graph like that. We could certainly ask the department, using their incidence database, to prepare a chart like that, or we could produce one using the income tax model. I think you'll see basically the same kind of pattern that you see. Obviously, the charitable contribution one is the most extreme in terms of, you know, more of the benefits being in that 10th decile.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right, go ahead and proceed.
Madam Chair, continuing with the charitable contribution subtraction for non-itemizers, this graph we see a little bit different shape, and the tax expenditure for this item is progressively distributed. So it's only being claimed for non-itemizers. If it were repealed, the income tax would become less progressive. It does not fully equalize the tax benefit of making charitable contributions for non-itemizers. That's because it only allows half of the contributions that they make over that $500 floor to be subtracted, whereas somebody who itemizes can deduct all of their contributions up to certain limits. The $500 sort of gets at a point Representative Garofalo was making earlier. That was tied to what was sort of implicitly assumed to be represented in the standard deduction. So the thinking was that, okay, the $500 floor that you have to get over to get this, claim this subtraction, is what you're already benefiting from under the federal standard deduction, which is flowing through to the state tax. and we're going to give you a tax benefit for the part that's over the $500. That was then also limited to 50% of the part over the $500.
On page 18 of your handout, interest on Minnesota state and local government bonds. Interest paid on bonds issued by Minnesota government units is exempt from taxation. In fiscal 08, $50.6 million is the estimated revenue loss to the general fund, and about 74,000 returns benefited from this tax exemption in tax year 2007.
The tax exemption for Minnesota bonds has been a feature, again, of the tax since it was enacted in 1933, starting in the late 1960s, I think in 69, when the federal government started restricting the types of bonds that were exempt. Minnesota followed those federal rules. In terms of related direct spending programs, obviously to the extent that the state is issuing these bonds, we're paying the interest on them, and so the exemption is sort of a way you can pay interest directly by paying higher interest, or you can pay lower interest that's exempt from taxation. And it's generally accepted that that's the rationale for this exemption, which is because it's tax exempt, presumably borrowers will accept a lower interest rate.
Mr. Michael, do you have more to add, or we'll have a question? Representative Davis?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michael, the statement was made that the state loses X number of dollars because of tax-exempt bonds. But my question would be, how much are they really losing when, if they weren't tax-exempt bonds, nobody'd buy them?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, I was just going to get to that point, after we talk about the incidents, so I'll wait on that until we go through the incidents. But
Madam Chair,
if you look at the graph, you'll see that probably of all of the tax expenditures we're looking at, this is the sort of the most concentrated over on the right side with 81%. And if you look at the suits index on it, the suits index is actually almost double what the general income tax is. Now, the point at which goes to Representative David's point, that's a little misleading. And the reason why it's misleading is when you buy a tax-exempt bond, you accept a lower interest rate in return for the tax exemption. And economists talk about that lower interest rate as including what's called an implicit tax. And so let's say you could have earned 7% in a taxable bond, and you're accepting 5%. Obviously, the 2% interest that you forego, that's a cost to you. And, of course, this graph does not take that into account. And so it's a little bit overstated in the sense that the benefit of this is not really the full nominal amount, but it's the difference between the implicit tax and what you could have realized on a taxable bond, which now I'll get to try to answer Representative David's question. And that's, and the basic question about whether this is an effective way of reducing interest rates for state and local governments relates to the question, so there's directly a question of, are we foregoing more in tax than we save in interest costs? If we're not, then it's not a very cost-effective way. I know Representative Davis, I think, sort of jokingly was saying, gee, nobody would buy these bonds if they're taxable. But, of course, that's not really true. The state does issue some taxable bonds because there's some things that you can't issue tax-exempt bonds for. And, of course, people buy them because they know the state is likely going to pay them back, just like any other borrower would, and in fact probably is more secure. Well, there have been some studies that have been done of the effectiveness of the tax exempt, using the tax exempt mechanism as a way to reduce interest rates. And in general, there have been a lot of studies done of the federal exemption because that's a big deal nationally. And almost all of those show that for every dollar that the federal government gives up in revenue, state and local governments save somewhere between 60 cents and 90 cents, and it varies based on market conditions and other sorts of things. And the reason for that is fairly simple to understand. The value of this exemption is higher the higher the tax bracket you're in. So if you're in the top federal tax bracket, you get the biggest advantage of the exemption. if you're in a lower federal tax bracket, you don't get as big a benefit. Now, when these bonds are sold, they frequently have to, almost always, they need to be priced so that somebody who's in the lower bracket will actually benefit from them. So, for example, it might be the 28% bracket rather than the 35% bracket. And so if they're priced to sell to somebody in the 28% bracket, and you're an investor who's in the 35% bracket, suddenly you're not paying an implicit tax that is big as the interest savings. So you're getting actually a little bit of an additional benefit. And that's why it's not a very cost-effective way of reducing interest rates. And that's why those federal studies show that, gee, the federal government is probably giving up a dollar and the state and locals are maybe saving 75 cents. So it would actually be more cost effective for them actually just to pay the money over to the local government and have the local government issue taxable bonds. And in fact, in the most recent federal stimulus bill, they're doing that for these what are called tax credit bonds. But now the question is, what about the state exemption? And there are many fewer studies, but those studies tend to show that the trade-off is even worse. There was one study in the National Tax Journal that said, look, for these state exemptions, every dollar you lose in revenue, you maybe save 50 cents in lower interest costs. And if you think about it, it's pretty easy to understand why that would be the case. Unlike the federal bonds, which almost never sell to anybody who doesn't benefit from the tax exemption, in the state context, many times we have to issue bonds that will sell to people who don't benefit from the state tax exemption. In other words, a taxpayer who doesn't live in Minnesota and doesn't pay state income tax. And so if you're going to issue bonds that sell, that, you know, if the state, for example, issues bonds that are going to sell to a New York investor, the New York investor is going to say, I don't care that these bonds are exempt from Minnesota tax. And so therefore, there's no way I'm going to accept a lower interest rate to buy that bond. But of course, those bonds are priced uniformly, and so then if a Minnesota resident buys it, they get the price that had to be set to sell to the New York resident, but they also get the tax exemption at the Minnesota level. And that's why you end up with this fact that the exemption is not really a very cost-effective way of reducing interest rates.
Representative
Lincoln,
you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Michael, in addition to that discussion, can you remind me, and I may be confusing this with something else, but wasn't there litigation in Kentucky related to this issue recently, and did that get resolved, and how is Congress looking at this?
Madam Chair, Representative Lincoln, yes, there was a challenge that was filed to most states. Now, most states have the same system that Minnesota has, where we tax out-of-state bonds, but we don't tax Minnesota bonds. And so some investors sued and said, hey, you're discriminating against interstate commerce. Supreme Court decided that case in favor of the states and said, that's okay because we're going to give your government and we're going to give governments a special exemption from the Commerce Clause. There are a number of states, and a few of them clustered around Minnesota that do not follow our practice. So, for example, Wisconsin and Illinois both tax their own, almost all of their own bonds. For precisely, I think when they instituted their income tax system, they thought through this and said, "Gee, that's not a cost-effective way to reduce our borrowing costs. So we're going to just issue state taxable bonds and pay a little bit higher interest rate and collect the state tax on those bonds." The other factor that makes this not a good trade-off is that when you pay state tax, it's deductible in computing your federal tax. So, for example, if you're in the top federal bracket, most of these are high-income people that buy these bonds because, the benefit is bigger the higher your tax bracket. But if you're in the top federal tax bracket, the 35% federal tax bracket, your state income tax is deductible against the federal tax. And so you're not really going to pay the full state income tax if you bought a taxable municipal bond, because 35% of you will reduce your federal tax by 35% of that under the itemized deduction. So again, when you come back to thinking about how these bonds are priced, a rational investor is not going to be willing to accept a lower interest rate that's equal to the nominal state tax savings, because they really don't pay that, because there's this itemized deduction that actually shifts some of that cost to the federal government. So that, those are sort of all of the technical explanations why this is sort of not the cheapest or most cost-effective way to do that. Now, there are people that are big, you know, the local governments, though, say do not tax this bond interest, because unlike your state aids, this is pretty reliable. We know you've never, since 1933, taxed this bond interest, and so if you do, we don't know that you're going to pay a state aid instead, and most of these bonds are local bonds. And their other concern that they have is, hey, if you start taxing municipal bonds, then the federal government might say, hey, that's a good idea, we'll start doing the same thing, and we'll lose this implicit federal aid that comes with the federal tax exemption.
All right, we have several questions. We'll just go in order. Representative Carlson?
Madam Chair, when I look at the chart you have up there, it's got the debt valves, 90% of the sale. We had a hearing in capital investments the other day where the Department of Finance wants to be able to issue a certain percentage of the bond to Minnesota investors. And part of what they were telling us was that they would like to sell them in smaller denominations, maybe 500 or 1,000. These, I assume, are probably 5,000 or more. And raised the question of access to the smaller investor that might be able to invest 500 or 1,000. My point is, and I don't know if you want to respond or not, is that that might change that graph there if more people had access.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that's probably true right now. If you're going to buy municipal bonds, the Minnesota municipal bonds, there are a number of other states that have those arrangements like that. You actually have to go to a broker to buy them, and there's a certain part of the market that would generally not, they're averse to dealing with brokers, and so they probably would never access bonds that way. And yes, the dollar amount is, the typical coupon on a municipal bond is $5,000. But keep in mind, the way most people buy municipal bonds, small investors, is through mutual funds, particularly through single state mutual funds, single state tax exempt mutual funds. And those have much lower minimums, and smaller investors are frequently more comfortable with doing that. And the other advantage to that is it provides some diversity, so those mutual funds hold, a lot of different bond issues. Now, with these bonds that the state is talking about are state GO bonds, which are presumably very, very secure, so that's probably not an issue.
All right, I have Representative Lofer and then Fulberg.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Mike. My question is actually sort of along the lines of Representative Carlson's, and that is, do we have evidence that this actually helps create a market? I mean, right now the bond market for the last 6 months or longer has been pretty uneven. And if we were to look at any changes in that, would that potentially make it more difficult for our local governments to issue debt?
Madam Chair, Representative Walker, I think you can think about that two ways, and it might be useful to think about the market as two different parts of it. At one level, what this tax exemption tends to do is to narrow the market. So basically it says, look, we're trying to sell bonds to who? Not to investors outside of the state, because we're presumably pricing this exemption into the rate on the bond. So your market then is really just Minnesota. Ideally, it's Minnesota buyers. Otherwise, you get this phenomenon that I indicated before, where if you have to sell some of the bonds to out-of-state investors, those equivalent bonds, when they're purchased by in-state investors, we probably won't get as much benefit from that exemption. So at one level, we're sort of giving up on selling these bonds nationally, and so the market's narrower. But very small issuers, so if you're talking about small schools and school districts and so forth, they probably would have a hard time marketing their bonds in New York or California or Florida, etc. And those are the municipalities that more likely benefit what you're saying, that there may be an adverse effect if we withdraw this, because then they're not as attractive to these home state buyers as they would be with the tax exemption.
All Did you have a follow-up, Representative Rossler?
No.
Okay, all right. Representative Tolbert.
Madam Chair, Mr. Michael, do we have an idea of how the mix is, of what percentage of the bonds that are sold in Minnesota in any particular year are given by state or school districts or local municipalities? Do we have a mix of that percentage, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Tolbert, I don't have that information, but we could... I think that if we compiled state auditors' data on debt, we could come up with a pretty rough approximation of that. It might miss. There's also a bunch of this debt that is what is called private activity bonds that are sold on behalf of, like, private colleges, hospitals, and that kind of thing that probably don't show up in the state auditors' data. But for the GO government bonds, we could sure get that from the state auditor's data for you.
But one other additional follow-up, if I may. You mean that the private colleges, when they sell a bond, is tax-exempt at all?
I'm sure, Representative Solberg, typically those bonds are done as what are called 501c3 nonprofits. It's not the college itself that's selling the bonds, but they would go to the city of St. Paul or the city of Northfield or something like that and ask them to issue bonds on their behalf.
Representative Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is something that I have a little bit of experience in. And I just wanted to let the committee know that if you don't follow this kind of thing, the broad market indices for the equity market is down about 35 to 45%. And the municipal bond funds are down about 4 to 5%. So these are very, very stable investments that people invest in, not wholesale investments where they put all of their net worth into these, but these are things in your communities that they build sports arenas and colleges and all kinds of things with, and they're very, very stable, predominantly because, number one, they go out and insure the most of the bond funds that I'm aware of go out and buy private insurance to insure the bond so that against default. And secondly is that it's usually backed by the full faith and taxing credit, unless Mr. Michaels wants to correct me, of the jurisdiction that issues the bonds. So they're very, very stable, and I can tell you that a lot of people that I know have them as a part of their portfolio, even though they aren't the greatest in return. They're so stable and so reliable that I just have some experience in this, and I thought you might be interested to know that it's almost the fluctuation. For example, one of the funds that I have was at a high in July of $12.20 a share. It's a mutual fund, and yesterday or Friday it was trading at $11.83. But I can tell you that the stocks that I also have aren't anywhere near that reflection, sadly enough. But it just is a very, I think it's a very good thing. Now, whether or not it comes out in terms of the tax end for the state revenue versus what, I heard what Mr. Michael said. I wish he wouldn't have said that, actually. Carolyn Chesky, I wish he wouldn't have said that. She knew I was talking directly to her.
All right, okay. We got two more questions. Quickly, Representative.
The follow-up on that. The tax issue doesn't really make it less stable or more stable. It's still backed up by the same state of procedures.
Mr. Gill, to that point?
Well, yeah, it's the underlying collateral and the underlying full faith and credit. You know, I don't know when you heard the last time that a municipality defaulted on a tax-exempt bond or any of the sponsors. Maybe Mr. Michael could tell us how many of those have happened in any recent time.
Mr. Michael, any information?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know the answer to that. There have been a few revenue bonds, including in Minnesota, that have defaulted. For example, the St. Paul Port Authority on some of its revenue issues a while back had some problems. But I am not aware of anywhere there are GO bonds in Minnesota that have had problems. In other states, that's not always the case. I know, for example, there's some California municipalities now that are actually in bankruptcy, but that's very rare.
Okay. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the 501c3 bonds. Those actually don't they have to be owned by the municipality the property and then like a long-term 99-year lease or something like that? Or that's my first question, but the other one was, of the non-GO bonds, what percentage roughly are exempt?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, on the 501c3 bonds, those are not required to be, they're required to be issued by the municipality, but the property is not usually owned by the municipality. So it's the private college or the hospital bonds are probably the most common. And those facilities are just owned by the hospital, but the city issues them on behalf of the hospital. As to your second question, it's a very, very small part of private activity, which are a type of revenue bond, that are issued, that are taxable. The federal tax exempt rules were narrowed considerably in 1986, and there are some of these things that cannot be done except with taxable bonds, and I don't know what the percentage would be, but I'm sure it's under 5%. So they simply don't. Then most of these borrowers then just go into the corporate bond market and borrow instead of trying to use the, and so it's largely municipal enterprises that can't qualify that are issuing. Like the state issues a very, very small amount of taxable bonds, for example.
Other questions? All right. If not, we will continue. And just to note to members that we will be adjourning at 4:15, so we in likelihood will not finish this, and we'll continue at a later date.
Madam Chair, on page 22 of your handout, expenses of living organ donation subtraction. Organ donors are allowed a subtraction from federal taxable income for certain costs incurred when donating all or part of a body organ. The revenue impact in fiscal 08 is less than $50,000, and an unknown number of Minnesota returns benefit from this provision.
The rationale for this subtraction was to provide tax incentives to increase the supply of transplantable organs by making it less of a financial burden for people to take time off of work to recover from having donated an organ. The federal government has a program that provides funding to reimburse work expenses for lower income people who choose to donate an organ. It's not an entitlement, it's by application. There was not any incidence information available on this subtraction because of the small number of people who claim it from 1 year to the next. And we haven't been aware of any studies on the effectiveness of this sort of subtraction in encouraging organ donations. It may have been motivated more as an attempt to provide recognition of the sacrifices that donors incur rather than to really provide an incentive to change anyone's behavior. If you think about it, if you have the maximum foregone work expenses of $10,000, if you're in the top income bracket, the most benefit you're going to get for that is 7.85%, which is going to be $785, so not very much money out of the amount that you've foregone in wages. If that goal is to encourage donations, Minnesota could consider instead having something similar to the federal law that provides direct payments to lower income organ donors.
On page 24 of your handout, there's a subtraction for K-12 education expenses. A state income tax subtraction is allowed for K-12 education-related expenses, such as tuition, textbooks, and transportation. The deduction is up to $2,500 for grades 7 through 12 and $1,625 for each dependent in grades K through 6. The tax expenditure report shows $18.4 million in revenue loss for this subtraction, and an estimated 230 returns benefited from this provision in tax year 2007.
This deduction was first enacted in 1955. It was challenged in 1983 on constitutional grounds, and it was upheld. The findings are shown there for you under the objective or rationale. At the time, it was challenged. It had recently been increased, and it was increased once again in 1998. Some of the earlier expansions of the amount of this deduction, one of the objectives was to keep private schools viable in order to alleviate overcrowding in public schools. So when it was expanded in 1976 and 1981, there was overcrowding in public schools, some of the infrastructure was old, and there was concern that the private schools weren't going to be able to absorb the students that weren't able to physically fit into the public schools. So there was interest across the political spectrum in expanding this to encourage the viability of the private schools as alternatives. As related direct spending programs, the state does provide funding for public education. In addition, the state provides a number of direct appropriations in which public school districts are required to provide various services and supplies to non-public school students, and the appropriation amounts are shown in that section, unrelated direct spending programs. The distribution of this expenditure is skewed towards the higher decile taxpayers. It's generally thought that most of the people who are claiming the maximum subtraction of $1,625 for students in grades K through 6 or $2,500 for students in grades 7 through 12 are doing so to pay non-public school tuition, and that they are more likely to be in the higher income deciles, which the incidence study data bears that out. We're not aware of any studies of the effectiveness of the subtraction. The tax savings are pretty modest at $200 per child, even for somebody at the maximum subtraction. Somebody itemizes their deduction, then you have the effect of the federal offset that Mr. Michael mentioned earlier. When your state income taxes go down, then your federal income taxes go up. So if you're in the top federal bracket, when you save the amount at the state level, you pay a little bit more at the federal level. In response to the rationale that this deduction was going to alleviate overcrowding in public schools, we're in a sort of a changed environment now. There are more charter schools. There are more alternatives for students than there were in the 1970s and 1980s. Yeah.
Madam Chair, if you would just send from out, we have a question. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure I understood that there's nothing, did I understand right, that there's studies would show that this doesn't really induce more to go to the private schools. It just gives basically a deduction or some extra money to those that were going to send them there anyhow.
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, I must have misspoke. We're not aware of any studies on the effectiveness of this subtraction.
Sorry.
Madam Chair, Ms. Manzi pointed out that I skipped a subtraction on page 23, the disposition of farm property. This one we probably cover pretty quickly. This is a subtraction from federal taxable income. For income realized on a sale or exchange of farm property, if the taxpayer is insolvent at the time of sale, and the proceeds are used to discharge indebtedness of the property sold, subtraction, for the revenue impact, the report shows less than $50,000 and an unknown number of returns benefit from the subtraction.
Members of the committee, this, in terms of objective or rationale, this was enacted in 1985, sort of at the tail end of the farm crisis in the 1980s, and was perceived as a way to help farmers who were experiencing pretty severe financial distress. The legislature repealed it in 1987 because Congress had enacted an expansion of the discharge of indebtedness rules for farmers, and it was thought that that would cover it, but then reenacted it in 1988 because, unlike the federal provision, this exempts capital gains as well as discharge of indebtedness income. We have sort of no way of assessing how, you know, effective this is in helping farmers out. In other words, to what extent farmers actually sell their property and then use that to pay down the debt, as opposed to having the bank or the lender reduce the debt directly, which is what the federal provision addresses.
Madam Chair, I believe we're on page 27. This is the AmeriCorps Education Award subtraction, and this is a subtraction that was enacted last year, and it is allowed for the amounts received from National Service Education Awards from the such as AmeriCorps, and the revenue estimate projects that this will cost, or the revenue impact will be $110,000. And the revenue estimate projects that 587 taxpayers will benefit from this subtraction this year.
This subtraction was initially enacted in 1997, and it was enacted to go hand in hand with what was then called the Youth Work Program, and which has merged with and become part of the AmeriCorps program. It was repealed in 2005 under the mistaken understanding that these post-service education awards were no longer being paid, when what had really happened is that the source of funding had shifted, and that's why it was reenacted in 2008. The rationale isn't totally clear. What happens is people serve in AmeriCorps or previously in Youth Works, and it's a program similar to the Peace Corps where they engage in service, but within the United States. And once their service is over, they receive these education awards to help them continue to pursue their education. Some of the people who are receiving these education awards are going to school, don't have a high income, and don't have a lot of tax liability anyway, so they're not able to benefit for this subtraction, so it's not obvious how it's really furthering its goal. An alternative to consider would be to simply provide an additional monetary award to people who provided this kind of service. And as Ms. Templin noted, it's a very small number of taxpayers from one year to the next. In fact, there may be more people who benefit from it, but there's a small number of people who have tax benefits, so it's sort of skewed that way too, where there might be 1,000 people receiving the post-education service awards, but only the 500 and something who are able to actually benefit from the income tax subtraction.
Okay, on page 28 of your handout, there is an elderly and disabled exclusion. Persons who are age 65 or over or totally disabled are allowed a subtraction from federal taxable income. In fiscal 08, the 2008 report shows $1 million in revenue loss, and an estimated 8,000 returns are expected to benefit, or did it benefit from this provision in 2007. This is one of the few tax expenditures where the revenue impact is decreasing. I had to ask about that phenomenon. one of the theories why this is the revenue impact is decreasing is because it's not a Social Security, and Social Security is indexed, but the parameters of the program are not indexed. So that provides a little bit of the background for the decreasing revenue impact.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the objective for this subtraction is another one where the objective isn't totally clear. Minnesota had a public pension exemption from 1933 to 1977, and then there was a subtraction allowed from 1978 to 1986 that was limited to a maximum amount with offsets for Social Security benefits. That was repealed in 1987 as part of tax reform, and then in 1988 this elderly subtraction was enacted. And in 1994, partly in response to the increase in the percentage of Social Security benefits that were included in taxable income from 50% to 85%, there was like a three-year phase-in provision tagged on to this elderly exclusion in effect from 1994 to 1996. And at the same time, the base amounts and the phase-out threshold for the elderly exclusion were increased on a one-time basis at that point. And that increased the number of people who were eligible for it. Generally, in order to claim this exclusion, you have to have very low amounts of Social Security benefits and very low income. There are not a lot of people who are eligible for it, about 8,000. there's some evidence from our work with the individual income tax sample that there are people who calculate the amount that they're able to claim incorrectly by failing to offset Social Security. It's one rationale for it is that it's going to provide a subtraction to people who don't get a lot of Social Security that will be the equivalent of the at least 15% of Social Security that's excluded for people who do get a lot of Social Security. Ms. Templin also noted that it's decreasing over time. That's largely because the parameters for calculating it aren't indexed for inflation. Also, on sort of a longer-term basis, more people are in classes of employment that are covered by Social Security now than there might have been who were, and not just people who are working now, but people who are retired now than there were 20 years ago. We don't have any evidence on the effectiveness of it. We do have some evidence, and not really anecdotal, but evidence from the income tax sample that there are people claiming it who may not be eligible. It's not clear how many of those revenue goes on to investigate. The incidence shows most of it falling in the lower and middle part of the income distribution. You do see a little bit of it falling at the upper end, which would either be people who have a lot of tax-exempt income or people who are claiming this subtraction without really being eligible for it.
Right. On page 31 of your handout, the subtraction from military pay. Minnesota allows a subtraction from taxable income for military pay for active service performed by members of the full-time military. This description is probably deceptively simple, and I'll defer to Ms. Manzi to give the detail on that. But looking at the revenue impact for fiscal 2008, $4.3 million in revenue loss is reported in the 2008 expenditure report. I should note that in fiscal 10 that the subtraction was expanded in 2008, and the estimate shows a $7.8 million in revenue loss. Actually, it should, we just quickly updated this, and it should be actually $7.9 million in revenue loss. An estimated 14,000 returns per year claim the subtraction. And
your paper, so I can put the graph. Okay. Thank you. This subtraction has been enacted bit by bit since 2001. It was initially enacted as an exemption for service performed outside of Minnesota by people in what I, as someone not in the military, think of as the regular full-time military, in contrast to the reserve components, which would be the National Guard and the Reserve. At the time it was enacted, nobody from the Minnesota National Guard had been deployed in active service outside of Minnesota since, I believe, World War II. So there wasn't a lot of contemplation of these National Guard call-ups to serve outside of the state and outside of the country at the time. The objective at the time it was first enacted in 2001 was to encourage people who were career military and moving around being stationed from state to state to maintain their Minnesota residency. A lot of parents of these people came in and spoke about how important it was to them that their sons and daughters maintained their residency and hopefully would return to Minnesota to live when they separated from the military. Then the world changed, and we have National Guard and Reserve members being deployed outside of Minnesota. This shifted to be it had been just an exclusion. It was exemption from the filing requirements, and then we changed it to be a subtraction for active service pay for service performed outside of Minnesota. Later, there was interest in providing still more benefits to members of the military as this deployment became sort of an ongoing thing where people were called up and deployed outside the state multiple times, and we began adding components for training that occurred outside of the state, and finally, in last session, for National Guard and Reserve training that occurs inside the state. During the same time period, the federal government prohibited us from taxing the pay of non-residents who are in the military but stationed in Minnesota using our credit for taxes paid to other states formula, but instead we had to just give them a straight subtraction, so that was added in here now. Where we're at for tax year 2009 is that we subtract pretty much all military pay except for pay for members of the active guard reserve, which includes the adjutant general staff and the adjutant general, and people who are called to service to perform administrative tasks for the Department of Military Affairs. The graph on the incidence of this shows the distribution of the military pay subtractions that were in effect in the year of the incident study, which is tax year 2006. So they aren't able to put in the other subtractions that we've added since then. They show that overall it makes the system, let's see, more progressive, although there's a chunk going to the top decile. I'm not going to speculate as to what that is. We don't have any evidence on how many people in the full-time military have decided to maintain residency in Minnesota because of the subtraction, which is the initial exemption. It seems likely that the exemption for National Guard and Reserve members for their training pay and for deployment out of state is going to serve as probably a welcome wage supplement during that time when they may be foregoing their civilian wages. We did explore in some of these iterations whether we could just pay people more in military pay rather than give them a tax exemption, and we learned from the Department of Military Affairs that that would be difficult for them to administer since most of the pay, even for members of the Guard and Reserve, comes through the U.S. Department of Defense and is administered by the U.S. Department of Defense. So that's why we've gone ahead with the income tax subtraction.
All right. Members, we've reached 4:15, so I think we will halt with the presentation at this point. I would ask members if you would put these in your shared folders since they are sizable and we don't have to distribute more copies than necessary. And we'll continue this at another time. And just a quick reminder, tomorrow's time will be used by the Property Tax Division. They're going to be meeting at 10:30 tomorrow morning. So our joint meeting with Property Tax Division is tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, in room 200 for the Green Acres show. With that, your committee is adjourned.